Welcome to Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. One of the major recent stories in oncology is the rapid evolution in the use of PARP inhibitors in both breast and ovarian cancer. I met with Dr. Richard Penson for his take on these fascinating agents, and he began by commenting on BSI-201, which was the subject of a fascinating plenary presentation at ASCO on triple-negative breast cancer in combination with carboplatin gemcitabine, and findings from another agent, olaparib, which was the subject of a major ASCO oral presentation as monotherapy in ovarian cancer, and a recent article in the New England Journal.
There's maybe a little bit of a paradigm shift in that it's not clear whether the olaparib is sort of a resistance-reversing agent and the chemotherapy is most important. It could be totally the other way around, that the key drug is the PARP inhibitor, and you're just damaging a bit more DNA with your chemotherapy. And so the normal repair of DNA damage by the enzymes in the cell that's being disrupted by the PARP inhibitor, that's augmented by the chemotherapy. So whatever, when we try to kill more cells with chemotherapy, people anticipate a bigger differential benefit with a PARP inhibitor.
And in ovarian cancer, are responses seen in patients who do not have BRCA mutations?
Yeah, there are. In that phase one clinical trial from Fong in the New England Journal of Medicine, there were responses for PARP inhibitors in patients who weren't known to carry a BRCA mutation. And the thought is that there may be some activity in cells who have competent DNA repair, but there's a fairly large number of patients who don't carry a BRCA mutation but have this BRCA-ness, either at some epigenetic event around those key genes, maybe more likely something that's not inherited in their germline, not something you got from your maternal or paternal genes, but that has mutated in the tumors, an acquired mutation, or maybe just something functional in terms of how the proteins fold, how they behave, how much of the protein there is, how much expression of the protein there is in the tumors. And all of those things are being looked at ways of trying to evaluate BRCA-ness in tumor samples or patients.
Now, has olaparib been used with chemotherapy?
Yeah, there are some clinical trials both in Europe and in America, in Boston, New York, Bethesda. We're at a relatively early phase. There's a bit of a discrepancy with the data that comes out. So there was this suggestion in the phase one clinical trial that there didn't seem to be more toxicity in patients who carried the BRCA mutations when it was given as a single agent. So one of the things you worry about is if this is an important Achilles heel and you exploit that, maybe the other cells, if you've inherited this predisposition mutation, are going to be more vulnerable to the agent. You're going to get toxicity. And there's definitely some hematologic toxicity. The actual dose-limiting toxicity of olaparib was sort of mood alteration and fatigue. But hematologic toxicity was definitely seen. In the phase one clinical trials, particularly with myelosuppressive agents like carboplatin, there's been a lot of toxicity. And one of the challenges is getting the PARP inhibitor at a dose with a reasonable dose of chemotherapy, that the synergy between the two agents may be exciting against the cancer, but potent enough that it's hard to give what we think of as standard doses of chemotherapy.
Now, the PARP inhibitor that was reported at ASCO by Joyce O'Shaughnessy with breast cancer, BSI-201, has that been looked at in ovarian cancer?
There's going to be some clinical trials. We're going to be doing two at MGH in Boston through the Dana-Farber-Harvard Cancer Center.
So right now, is this in the realm of just sort of early clinical research without any clear-cut patient benefit issues, or based on what we've seen, does participation in trials with these agents maybe potentially really offer a patient something useful clinically?
Right. So I think there's enough clinical benefit reported in peer-reviewed publications now that that's unequivocal benefit of the agent. There's sort of a few steps to clinical benefit. So the first is unequivocal clinical benefit. So in an uncontrolled study, if you don't have a problem with a new agent, maybe as few as 100 patients getting benefit and could lead to approval. But typically, the Food and Drug Administration requires controlled clinical trials to get approval. So this is exciting enough that that's moving fairly rapidly.
I guess sometimes you get in a situation like right now, to me, the agent T-DM1 in breast cancer is kind of like that, where you really see that people are benefiting, and yet you know it's not going to really be available for a while, and really kind of changes the way you think about getting patients into studies. Any sort of guess when we might be seeing one of these PARP inhibitors actually available, FDA approved?
The anticipation is it's going to be about 3 years.
Wow.
In that there's going to be a 400-patient follow-on study from that triple-negative bypass study that you mentioned, Joyce O'Shaughnessy study. So that was sort of a randomized phase two. There's going to be a definitive phase three clinical trial in 400 patients that has been sort of designed, approved, and opened very rapidly. And that study is anticipated to enroll fast. And my understanding is that if it's positive and confirms those initial very encouraging results, that the drug will sort of be expedited to approval.
You talked about BRCA-ness. Are we anywhere close to finding a tissue biomarker that might predict responsiveness to this agent? And what do you think it might be?
I think there's going to be a few things. So the tissue marker may be as simple as staining for the protein for BRCA 1 and 2. They're large genes, so the Myriad Genetics test looks for mutations in the genes, and that's relatively more complicated. But there might be that simpler tests of epigenetic phenomena are sort of in between those two things, the functional evaluation of protein and the genes themselves. The challenge with the acquired genes is you have to be looking in tumor, and that can be hard to find abnormalities in big genes. In between those, it's thought that methylation status of the genes may be very important. The promoter ahead of the gene that controls how much protein comes from that gene encoding the BRCA1 or 2 may be very important. And silencing of the gene with methylation is probably very important. There's not a commercial assay for that yet, but people are working on that.
If you had to guess, what fraction of patients overall with ovarian cancer do you think might benefit from some type of PARP inhibition?
Well, the hope is that a third to approaching a half may benefit.
What other biologic avenues and clinical research questions are out there that you think, you know, maybe in the next few years are going to come into practice?
I think if you said, well, what's the most exciting biologic agent at the moment, it would be Avastin and some of the anti-angiogenic agents. That's the sort of initial approach. You know, what's a lead candidate in being an exciting biologic? The second question is, well, you know, how do we really cure more people? And I think there's going to be a longer challenge in terms of defining exactly the molecular vulnerabilities in the tumor, what people are calling personalized medicine of a molecular signature in tumors, and then giving a cocktail of biologics to sort of revert a tumor to something that's more sensitive to treatment, correct resistance, get a sort of confluence of vulnerability that really allows tumors to be killed. A few years ago, the concept was that there was thousands of genes in tumors. And ovarian cancer is definitely one of those where there are thousands and thousands of genes that are affected. And that was a little depressing. But there are key pathways in which mutations cause cancer. And so the hope is that 4 or 5 of the key pathways are upset, and giving a biologic to either attack that vulnerability or correct the abnormality could really make a difference in terms of outcomes for patients. The toxicities from putting drugs together is hard to predict, and the sort of timeline to getting a fingerprint of exactly what should be given is only just starting, so it's hard to know how quickly that's going to explode as a field. So getting what we call a predictive marker for a response to an anti-angiogenic has been really difficult. And so, you know, the sort of negative interpretation of that is that there doesn't really seem to be anything that does predict things. You'd anticipate that having a lot of vascular endothelial growth factor around or a key drive through HIF-1 alpha, you know, predispose a tumor to be vulnerable to anti-angiogenic approaches. It may be that there are truly ways to evaluate things. One of the things that we've been looking at is soluble vascular endothelial receptor. How much of the receptor for growth factor is shed into the circulation? And is that a measure of sort of angiogenic tone in the system? How much is there a drive to the development of new blood vessels? And then when you give an anti-angiogenic, can that predict for benefit? But a lot of investigations have gone on looking at lots of potential predictive factors, and to date there's been no predictive factor that has proven its worth.
Now, the soluble receptor, is that coming from the tumor or from normal vasculature or what?
People have generally thought that the tumor is to blame, but it's much more complicated than that, from the bone marrow through to endothelial cells near the tumour, and this bizarre sort of mosaic of tumour cells and endothelial blood vessel cells that make up to sinusoids of tumour vasculature.
What do we know about the combination of chemotherapy and bevacizumab?
Well, I think what we really know at the moment is that there is a paradigm in which a lot of patients are given sequential chemotherapies concurrently with Avastin. There's a lot of clinical experience of patients benefiting, particularly with the control of ascites and pleural effusions, and they have clear responses in tumours. The randomised controlled trials have all are sort of either completing or close to completion. So the two registration studies in ovarian cancer are the GOG-218, which is a upfront study for patients with optimally or suboptimally cytoreduced ovarian cancer getting Taxol and carboplatin, or Taxol, carbo and platin plus Avastin, or Taxol and carboplatin plus Avastin and a year of consolidation of Avastin. And that study is placebo-controlled so that progression-free survival can be used as the primary endpoint. And that's completed accrual. The second study is the OCEAN study, which is a study in patients with platinum or potentially platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, gemcitabine and carboplatin with or without Avastin, again with a placebo-controlled design and treatment till progression of disease. And that study is fairly close to completion.
And when would you guess maybe either one of these studies might be reported?
People are thinking that the OCEAN study will report faster just because the events that are being analyzed will happen more quickly in patients who've already had recurrent disease, and as soon as 18 months or 2 years.
Do you think there's a role right now outside a protocol setting, just sort of putting aside the cost and reimbursement issues, which I would be actually curious about, for bevacizumab in ovarian cancer right now?
I think so. I think the sort of groundswell of opinion was codified by the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network publication, that gave Avastin a preferred drug status. And that's one of the things that can be cited for reimbursement. So exactly as you say, the financial implications are fairly large. A year of Avastin can cost you close to $100,000.
Now, you're talking about using it, though, in recurrent disease.
Correct.
Do you think there's any role in any situation for using it earlier outside of protocol?
It's much harder to use it earlier. A few patients have persuaded me to use it off protocol earlier, but very few, and with significant duress and a very sort of defensive set of statements in the chart that it's not the standard of care. It could be associated with a fatal complication that clearly we would all find devastating and regret. So at the moment, no, not for first-line therapy. I have quite a few patients who are out to 3 years on Avastin, not typically with just one drug, but with a sequence of drugs. You know, at MGH, we don't have anybody who's been on ovarian cancer into a fourth year yet, but we've got quite a few patients who've been into a third year. Vascular endothelial growth factor was originally called vascular permeability factor, and the permeability of blood vessels is through fenestrations, and capillary beds have a lot of fenestrations for the sort of surface area of endothelium. And vascular endothelial growth factor really opens those up, and Avastin really closes those down. And so a significant amount of the effect on serous effusions is a sort of vascular effect, not necessarily an anti-tumor effect.
What about the integration of bevacizumab into regimens that include intraperitoneal therapy?
Yeah, we've recently completed a phase 2 clinical trial based on a previous backbone of chemotherapy, which gives weekly Taxol intraperitoneally, and every 3 week carboplatin from the second cycle. We're giving both of those agents intraperitoneally, and the follow-up study was just adding Avastin 15 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks from the second cycle as first-line therapy. And the results have been good, and it's been well-tolerated without significant complications.
Just to finish out, though, in terms of new agents, what about other anti-angiogenic strategies, including TKIs?
So the convenience of having an oral daily medication is really appealing. I'm not sure patients find it too difficult, actually, coming up for an IV infusion, and often find the solidarity of their comrades and support of their medical team really helpful. But TKIs are interesting. I think some people think of them as being horribly broad-spectrum tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Some people like that because there's potentially multiple targets that you can hit. So there's a lot of interest, for example, in BRAF for lower grade tumors or MEK looks like it might be a valid target for ovarian cancer, and you could get something that would target MEK as well as the vascular endothelial growth factor receptor. So there are agents, for example, that do overlap on those targets.
Before you go on, whenever I hear the word BRAF, a light bulb goes off in my head, because, of course, the presentation by Keith Flaherty on melanoma at ASCO was so striking. And, of course, I think there were some thyroid patients. But what about ovarian? Do they have that same kind of mutation?
So they do, yes. We are doing a study. There's two studies at the moment. There's a national study of AZD6244 with the Gynecologic Oncology Group, and there have been quite a few responses, and that's due to open again soon.
Now, what fraction of patients have BRAF with ovarian?
Well, it's a little bit of a contested issue at the moment. If you look at borderline tumors, a lot. If you look at low-grade tumors, there's two institutions who are fighting over whether there's a lot or a little. So we don't exactly know. We're going to be looking at our data. That's an ongoing project.
Actually, didn't Keith Flaherty migrate up towards you or with you?
He did. He's now at MGH. So the second study actually is, as opposed to trying to identify the patient population who's likely to have BRAF mutations, we have a project with Don Lawrence at MGH, who Keith's joining, which we use John Iafragis, who's one of the molecular pathologists, to find BRAF mutations in tumors. And if patients carry that, then they're eligible for a study. So that study is a phase two of AZD6244 with patients with stomach cancer, melanoma, low-grade ovarian cancer. So it's a sort of molecularly targeted clinical trial.
Let's circle back, though, to angiogenesis in terms of TKIs. What about agents like sunitinib and other VEGF inhibitors?
So we've looked at cedarinib, which is AZD2171, and there's a paper coming out in JCO soon. Really good response rate in the mid-20s. A lot of clinical activity, quite a lot of toxicity in comparison to Avastin. We have a clinical trial of sunitinib at the moment. The most interesting sorafenib study is a Lise Cohn study with both sorafenib and Avastin. It accrued over a fairly long period of time. It was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology with a 40% response rate, which is quite remarkable. So with carefully selected patients, they can do incredibly well. There are a couple of patients who had fistulae, and the concern is when you are targeting a particular pathway with multiple agents, whether you're going to augment toxicity. I think probably it's true to say that most people at the moment are favoring parallel pathways. If you can hit multiple key genetic pathways in terms of trying to kill or control cancer.
I want to just ask you about a couple of presentations from ASCO that I thought were interesting. One being the plenary presentation that looked at using CA125 in terms of screening after cytoreduction and chemotherapy, showing that it didn't seem to provide any benefit by picking these recurrences up earlier. Anything you want to say about that database and what do you think it means?
So it's not been peer-reviewed yet and it's not been published, but it was anticipated for a long time and made a huge splash and was appropriately the number one plenary session this year. So Gordon Rustin presented this randomized controlled trial in which both the clinician and the patient were blinded to what was happening with their CA125. So patients were enrolled in the clinical trial, and then when their CA125 rose, they were one-to-one randomized to know that information, and more than 80% went straight on to chemotherapy, or to wait till there was clinical evidence of progression of disease and they started treatment for symptoms. And on average, it took 5 months longer for patients to get treatment if they were randomized to the control group. There was no difference on survival. And more importantly, there was a negative impact on quality of life. So the unequivocal conclusion of the study was that the malignant clone that kills patients isn't affected by early chemotherapy. And we can hurt patients with chemotherapy given before they have clinical progression of disease.
Did that data set in any way change the way you take care of patients?
It changed how I explain things to patients. It takes slightly longer to be more candid with patients. I think that's probably better for everybody in the end. But the sort of anticipatory grief about wrestling with a really hard disease is obviously not helped. But I don't know that clinical practice has changed very much. I think that in Beth Carlin's review of Gordon Rustin's data, she really pressed home the hope that certain subsets of patients could be identified where you can make a difference to their outcome by detecting isolated disease early, operating on them, and they will do better. Now, really, she should take on the responsibility of doing a study that shows that. But I think that philosophy is very prevalent, and there's a large number of patients who are treated still with multiple lines of therapy and roll from one therapy to another. And there's a hope that that is good for quality of life. But now the burden of proof rests with all of us who do that to show the benefit.
Our CME group does a lot of national patterns of care studies to try to figure out what people are doing, but we've never done one in ovarian cancer. I'm going to guess that before and after that paper, people are going to draw tumor markers, period, anyhow.
We actually published a paper in Gyn-Onc a few years ago, and one of the conclusions of the paper was that although physicians are criticized for driving that sort of medicalization of care and over-treatment, it's hugely driven by patients.
Totally.
And Martin Gore, in a nice review in Lancet Oncology, drew this little diagram of the addictive response that patients live in horror of what their CA125 might be. They get a fix with a normal result and huge relief. Their anxiety builds in anticipation of the next CA125, and they're totally addicted to that and devastated, obviously, when it goes up, because although there might be some reasons why it might go up, it's almost always reflective of tumor quite a few months in advance of progression on scan or with symptoms.
Another paper that I want to ask you about was a study called the Calypso study. I always like that name. It's kind of a simple design, but I thought it was pretty interesting. Could you kind of talk about what they looked at there and what you think it meant?
So the Calypso study was presented by Eric Pujar-Lorraine from Paris. And the previous study that challenged the standard of care in the States of giving Taxol and carboplatin for disease that's recurred more than 6 months out from previous treatment was a German study which gave gemcitabine and carboplatin. And the rhetoric after that was that obviously if you're giving platinum with a different agent, maybe you'll get a better outcome. And they showed a progression-free survival advantage over single-agent carboplatin. But actually, if you look at the overall survival statistics, it was no better. And they'd have to treat thousands and thousands and thousands of patients, about 20,000 patients, to show a difference in overall survival. This study, in dramatic contrast, didn't compare Doxil in addition to carboplatin with carboplatin. It compared Doxil with carboplatin against Taxol and carboplatin for platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer. And it not only showed equivalence of the two in terms of clinical benefit, but it showed a progression-free survival advantage, which is quite extraordinary. So patients actually did better on Doxil carbo than Taxol carbo for their recurrent disease. So I thought it was a big splash study, and I instantly changed over to using that for second-line therapy of platinum-sensitive disease and have treated about 5 people.
What was reported there in terms of side effects and toxicity, and what's your own experience with carbo liposome with doxorubicin?
So the really curious thing that was reported was that there was dramatically less allergy to carboplatin in the Doxil carboplatin arm, which hasn't really been fully explained. The toxicity looked pretty good, and so you potentially got no alopecia, a lot less neurotoxicity, and everybody anticipates better quality of life. But the hematologic toxicity was considerable. And there wasn't any information about dose adjustments and dose delays. And my clinical experience has been that there's been a lot of thrombocytopenia and neutropenia.
I know you're very interested in quality of life. What's your observation or your theory, or how do you see the quality of life on these two regimens?
So I think to not lose your hair and have less neurotoxicity is massive. If you have from the beginning a fatal disease and you can get carboplatin and gemcitabine and not lose your hair and then get Doxil and carboplatin and not lose your hair. I just literally this week had a patient die who'd never lost her hair with cancer, and I think that is of value to patients.
So when you saw these data, you actually changed what you're doing in your practice?
Correct.